Christian, we would thank you so much for being here today and for kicking off our lecture theory series.
Well, thank you very much, Mark, and that kind introduction. It's always nice when an institution that you were part of and which you were fond says, we still claim him as our own. It's always the most embarrassing possible introduction to go back to your old university and find that they'll talk about all the other institutions you've been associated with, but won't actually mention your connection with this one. And thank you also for giving up your time on a beautiful, clear, sunny day to come along and listen. Sometimes with standing room only, I gather that the centre is going to expand in the not-too-distant future and build a larger meeting room. Now, the subject that I've been asked to talk about today is the challenges of international litigation. There are many challenges, and to some extent, what they are depends on which side of the court you're standing or sitting. And as a number of the people here tend to stand on the other side of the court from the one where I now sit, I'm sure they will understand that the challenges vary. About the time I became a judge, I was talking with an English judge that I knew quite well, and he said, how are you finding it? Isn't it terrible going from being an advocate to having to sit and listen to people the whole time? And I said, well, I did remember the advice that was given by the late Lord Acner, a British Supreme Court judge, as we would say now, who said that every judge should have in front of him on the desk a little sign that said, shut up. You are paid to be irritated. Yes, said this judge. I remember that. You'll find after a year or two you want to turn it round to face the other way. And of course, one of the biggest challenges is that you're not free as a judge to do what I used to enjoy doing when I was a university lecturer, of saying whatever I thought about the subjects of the day. So I have to begin with the statutory disclaimer that what I say in my private capacity. It's my fault and my fault alone. It doesn't reflect any stance on the part of the court. And if you think you can find in what I'm going to say some clue to how we're about to decide a case, I can assure you that the clue is entirely unintentional and therefore lost even on me. Now, let me start by saying a little bit about international litigation in general, because the first thing you notice about it today is what a lot of it there is. Now, that wouldn't have been true 35 years ago this week, when I was in the position that many of you in this room are in now. In other words, I was just starting my postgraduate studies in international law, the LLB, as it was in those days, now the LLM. 35 years ago, the International Court of Justice had one case on its docket, the Aegean continental shelf dispute between Greece and Turkey. It gave not a single judgment or substantive order throughout the time I was a student of international law. It gave one 4-page time limits order, and that is the only entry in the 1977 International Court of Justice reports. Rather touchingly, in the bound volume, and judges of the court are all given a bound set to keep in their office, the set I inherited from Judge Para Aranguren of Venezuela, my bound volume has a little sticker in the back of it that says, this volume contains neither an index nor a table of contents. And underneath it, someone has written in pencil or anything else. And shortly after I completed my LLB, the court decided it didn't have jurisdiction over the only case. But the ICJ wasn't in the least bit unusual. Nothing much was happening in the world of arbitration either. Of course, lots of people were writing learned articles about ICSID. It just wasn't deciding any cases in those days. There was virtually nothing going on in the world of interstate arbitration, with the exception of an arbitration between Britain and France over the continental shelf in the area near the Channel Islands and the Western Approaches, which was somewhat spoilt by the fact that the tribunal gave an impeccable award, which was then translated into lines on the map by somebody who failed to take account of the fact that the Earth is round rather than flat, giving rise to rather interesting proceedings about what you can and cannot correct in an arbitration award. The entire case law of the European Court of Human Rights would have filled a single volume. I know, because one of the things that Sir Elie Lauterbach asked me to do when I graduated was to join him in working on the international law reports, and one of my first jobs was to fill a volume with all the jurisprudence of the European Court of Human Rights. There was no international tribunal on the law of the sea, no World Trade Organization, and if you talked about the role of international criminal law, people would frankly have laughed at you. It wasn't even a dream, wasn't even a bad dream in 1977. Now, the position today couldn't really be more different. The International Court has 15 cases on its books at the moment. By my reckoning, 88 states have been parties to contentious cases before the court. That's just short of half the states in the world. And in the recent proceedings on the advisory opinion request in relation to Kosovo's Declaration of Independence, 43 states and the Provisional Institutions of Self-Government of Kosovo took part in the proceedings before the court in one way or another, including many states that had never appeared in the ICJ before, the People's Republic of China being one striking example. The court today has cases from every inhabited continent in the world, and since the whaling case between Australia and Japan is about whaling in the Antarctic, I suppose you could say we have a case from the uninhabited continent as well. Interstate arbitration has never been busier. And even that is eclipsed by the extraordinary rise in investor state arbitration, which has seemed to grow rather like the fable of the young Chinese boy who did a favour for the emperor and was asked what he would like as his reward and said, a single grain of rice on the first square of a checkerboard, and then two grains on the second, four grains on the third, and it goes on doubling. The jurisprudence of ICSID and the Unsertrial case law on investor state arbitration has grown at something like that extraordinary pace. Human rights, the European Court of Human Rights receives over 50,000 applications a year. It gives something of the order of 1,400 judgments and substantive decisions each year. The World Trade Organization has a degree of activity in adjudicating disputes which the old General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade simply didn't see. And international criminal law? Well, it may be the case that the first thing that Colonel Gaddafi thinks about when he wakes up in the morning isn't, in fact, the ICC. But I'm prepared to lay a bet that he thinks about it at some point during the day, most of the days when he's awake. The big picture in national courts has changed dramatically as well, although my focus today is going to be on litigation before international courts and tribunals. In the 1970s, if you could try to persuade an English court of a point of international law, and here Elie Lauterbach is the person with all the experience to rely on, you would have had it would have been a tall order to get many English judges to take the point seriously at all. Today, you can invoke the UN Convention on State Immunity, which hasn't even entered into force, in front of a Deputy Supreme Court Master on a sovereign immunity application, and he or she will not bat an eyelid. So, the world we live in today is a world which we could reasonably describe as the age of adjudication. Those of you who are historians might like to think this is in contrast to the 18th century, which was known as the age of enlightenment. Is that a good thing? Well, I'll give you a clue. I'm not going to say that it isn't, am I? There's an old principle of international law, which is that you never break your own rice bowl in front of other people. So, yes, I do think this change has been a good one. Just to give a few examples of some of the beneficial effects that it's had. At the time I was a student, the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea was gradually coming to fruition. Somebody once said about the conference on the law of the sea that whereas the Congress of Vienna in 1814-15 was always described as a Congress that didn't decide, it just danced. The Law of the Sea Conference didn't even dance. But it was gradually coming to fruition, and that marked a dramatic change in the law of the sea, a movement in the space of a decade from a world in which most of the waters of the globe were raised communist into a world where very large parts of them fell within the territorial sovereignty of coastal states. In the case of the Mediterranean, the entire sea is taken up with claims or potential claims by one state or another. Now, that could easily have led to a 20th century equivalent of the scramble for Africa between the European powers at the end of the 19th century. That it didn't do so is, I think, in large part due to the case law of the International Court and the arbitration tribunals, which hammered out, mainly in the 80s and 90s, a series of principles about adjudicating disputes between overlapping claims, which have not only resolved the cases between the states that brought them, but have also provided an intelligent basis for settling a whole raft of other cases out of court. The World Trade Organization has, I think, made an invaluable contribution in being one of the bricks in the wall against the slide into protectionism in response to the economic crisis that we confront at the moment. I'm not suggesting for a minute that it's the only factor, or that it would be decisive if push really did come to shove, but it certainly made an enormous difference. Human rights, I will not enter into the debate about whether somebody's cat is a reason for not deporting them from the United Kingdom or not. The cat flap debate is one for others to resolve. But it is certainly the case that the growth in human rights jurisprudence has given not only a substantial fillip to the rise towards a democratic rule of law in many states that were dictatorships and seemed to be doomed to an eternal future of dictatorial rule when I was a student, but has also done a great deal for those groups who in democracies tend to get forgotten. When I was an LLB student here, a man was released from a secure mental institution in the Cambridge area, to which he had been committed for stealing a bicycle and then being found at the hearing not to be in his right mind. He was sent to Rampton in 1935 and released in 1977. There had, as far as I'm aware, been no review of whether it was necessary to continue detaining him for most of those 22 years. That cannot happen today is in large part a product of decisions of the European Court of Human Rights. And international criminal law, whatever criticisms people make of it, is, I think, beginning to put in place the idea that the threat of prosecution if you commit a war crime or a crime against humanity is a serious deterrent to people who are contemplating behaving in that way. We have, I think, some way to go in that regard, but we are, I think, well on the way. However, it's not an unalloyed good, ladies and gentlemen. Litigation is always a reflection of failure. You only end up in court, especially in a criminal court, if there has been a failure to prevent a breach of the law at an earlier stage. And one thing that I think we do need to be extremely cautious about as we celebrate, and rightly celebrate, the rising importance of international courts today, is that we should not allow resources to be diverted from other important features of law enforcement. It is more important to put money into educating soldiers so that they don't commit war crimes or crimes against humanity than it is to try a handful of people after the event. And yet trials are very much more expensive. Now, so much for the state of play as it was and as it is. As you can see, a great deal has changed in the 35 years. Even the weather is better than it was in Cambridge at the beginning of October in 1976. But the new world of adjudication of international disputes presents a number of very serious challenges as well. And I'd just like to look at a few of them in the course of my remarks today, and then I hope discuss some more perhaps with you in the course of questions. The first is that the pressure of the caseload, what a prime minister of my childhood would have called one of the problems of success, is something which you have to take very seriously with all of the international courts and tribunals today. It's at its most acute in the European Court of Human Rights. 50,000 applications a year is quite simply an unmanageable workload. Why is it unmanageable? Well, one of the reasons is that when the court was reconstituted some 15 years ago, no attempt was made, or rather an attempt was made, but it wasn't successful, to introduce some kind of filter mechanism for getting rid of cases which were merely duplicating other applications that had already been decided, or were simply crazy applications in the first place. Now, you may not think it's possible that any litigant could be described as crazy. If you're in any doubt about it, go along to the room in the Royal Courts of Justice where they deal with applications by people who have been declared vexatious litigants. Or read my favourite case from the United States Federal Rules Decisions, not a series that many people, even in the United States, would open with any sense of pleasure. In the 1974 Federal Rules Decisions, you will find the case of United States ex rel Gerald Mayo against Satan and his staff on Earth, in which the applicant wanted leave to file suit in former pauperies, which I take it to mean without paying fees, against Satan and his staff on Earth for infringing the plaintiff's constitutional rights by placing obstacles in his path wherever he went. In a lovely 1.5-page judgment, the federal district judge dismisses the application on three grounds. First of all, he didn't see how you could serve the writ on the defendant. Secondly, he thought it was at least arguable that Satan, as Prince of Darkness, was a head of state entitled to sovereignty. To my eternal regret, I didn't have the nerve to cite the case for that proposition in the Pinochet hearings. And thirdly, because a class action against the staff on Earth is permissible only if the staff are of a reasonably finite number. Whereas we all know Satan has so many staff, they can possibly fall within that. But the poor old European Court of Human Rights would have to deal with United States ex rel Mayo in its entirety. They wouldn't simply be able to throw it out. I think some kind of filter mechanism becomes essential in successful courts. Or take international criminal law. Now, the numbers here are much smaller. The Yugoslav and Rwanda tribunals between them have dealt with approximately 160 defendants. But the difficulties remain very serious. Take the Milosevic case, which grumbled on for over 2 years before it ended with Milosevic's untimely death in a prison about 0.5 mile from where I now live in The Hague. He was, incidentally, the head of the table tennis ladder amongst the prisoners. Now, the prosecutor in Milosevic has been criticised by many people for having overloaded the indictment. Let's just keep an eye on the difficulties that prosecutors face in these cases. The English approach would be to say, let's go for the charges we know we can prove. It will make no difference to sentence whether the man is convicted of murdering 150,000 people or 50,000 people. But that means telling the parents, the spouses, the children of the other 100,000, we're very sorry, but the death of your loved ones isn't going to feature in the indictment. We hear a lot, we read a lot, about the importance of international criminal courts as providing an historical record. Never lose sight of the fact that the historical record, that aspect of the court's work, is in direct conflict very often with the need for efficient, efficacious procedures which will bring trials to a conclusion in a reasonable period. Well, there's the International Court of Justice. Now, in numerical terms, our problems don't begin to compare with those of the European Court of Human Rights or the International Criminal Tribunals. But if you look at the extraordinarily transparent procedure which the court uses, we must be one of the very few courts in the world that publishes details of how our own internal processes work. You can find them in the resolution on the internal working practices of the court. Those practices are designed to produce both a collective judgment, such as you would get in many civil law countries, but also separate and dissenting opinions from individual judges. It has to be produced in two different languages. My French has improved a great deal as I've compared the English and French texts. The most ridiculously small points can create terrible difficulties if you are working in more than one language. Let me give you one example. For over 40 years, international lawyers have debated whether the fact that Security Council Resolution 242 on the Middle East, in calling for Israel to withdraw from, quote, territories occupied in the recent conflict, as opposed to the territories occupied, deliberately left open the possibility that some of those territories might be retained. Now, I'm not going to begin to enter into the debate about whether that was the intention. The debate itself has a linguistic problem, because that resolution is authentic not only in English, but also in French, Chinese, Russian, and Spanish. Chinese and Russian don't have a definite article, therefore the difference between territories and the territories is meaningless. French has a definite article, but because of the grammatical structure of the language, both territories and the territories would have appeared as des territoires in the French text. So only the English and Spanish texts raise the difficulty that I've just highlighted too. If we are to deal with the number of cases we now have to deal with in the International Court of Justice, it puts a considerable strain on using the working system that was devised at a time when one case a year was considered to be quite burdensome. Put bluntly, the problem is partly one of inadequate resources, but everyone is talking about inadequate resources today. The other aspect of it is the principle enunciated by Charles Dickens and put into the mouth of Mr. Micawber, that if your annual income is £20 and your annual expenditure is £19, 19 shillings and sixpence, the result is happiness. But if your annual expenditure is £20 and sixpence, the result is misery. You've got to be able to decide the same number of cases in a given year as are filed with you. Otherwise, you'll simply lapse into an eternal backlog. I don't know, incidentally, quite how Mr. Micawber would have reacted today if you tried to translate the maxim I've just quoted into euros. I suspect the emphasis would have been on misery rather than happiness, whichever way it was put. But it would have to go something like total annualised debt greater than 3.4 times GDP, result bailout by the IMF. Now, there are also serious practical difficulties in the criminal law sphere. If you start to hark back to a supposed golden era in the past, a lot of criminal lawyers in this country have a tendency to criticise the time taken in the ICTY or the ICTR and say, well, it wasn't like that in the past. In the past, they got through these cases expeditiously. Well, think a little bit more about that. Some of you may have come across the trial of Lieutenant Commander Eck at the end of the Second World War. Eck was the commander of a U-boat which torpedoed and sank a Greek merchant ship called the Peleus. Eck then surfaced, found out what ship he'd sunk, and spent the next 2 hours cruising up and down, machine-gunning the survivors in the water. He and three other members of his crew were put on trial by a British military court in 1945. They were convicted, and three of them were executed. Now, there's no doubt that Eck did commit the offence. There's no doubt it was a terrible one. And by the standards of the time, the sentence wasn't at all inappropriate. But the trial took 2.5 days. Defence counsel were briefed the day before the trial opened. The only evidence were unsworn witness statements given by the survivors who hadn't been victims of the machine gun fire, but who weren't called to give evidence and couldn't be cross-examined because they were on the other side of Europe and it was too expensive to bring them to Hamburg where the trial was taking place. There was only one copy in court of the British Manual of Military Law, the received textbook of the day on international law of armed conflict, but the prosecutor, whose copy it was, very kindly lent it to defence counsel during the lunch adjournment so the defence counsel could have a look at it as well. Now, however many criticisms you might have of the length of time the Milosevic case took, I don't imagine any of us want to go back to the summary justice, certainly summary justice, I'm not quite so sure, that was meted out to Lieutenant Commander Eck. All that taken into account, though, the challenge has got to be met. International courts and tribunals have got to find the means, somehow or other, to master the caseload that they have. In our world, the principle that justice delayed is justice denied has to be kept firmly in mind. And you also have to remember that justice delayed too much, too often, in too many different cases, could very easily mean justice abandoned in the future. We don't have compulsory jurisdictions. States that don't like it can go elsewhere, and they have done in the past. So that's one challenge. The second is the difficulty of fusing a wide variety of legal traditions. Lots of people ask, well, how do you cope with judges from civil law countries and common law countries sitting together? When it comes to substantive law, that really isn't a problem at all. But when it comes to procedure, it can be a different matter altogether. For example, any common lawyer will tend to have very clear views about the burden of proof. It obviously rests on the party which is asserting a particular proposition of fact, and the standard of proof, which in civil cases will be proof beyond balance of probabilities, and in criminal cases, proof beyond reasonable doubt. In my experience, most lawyers haven't the faintest idea quite where the difference between reasonable doubt and balance of probabilities resides. They couldn't quantify it, no matter how hard they tried, but nevertheless, that there is a higher standard of proof in a criminal case is straightforward. To a civil lawyer, it isn't straightforward at all. Even the balance of proof may shift between the parties much more readily than it tends to do in a common law environment. And as for the standard of proof, the test is not balance of probabilities or reasonable doubt, but the conviction intime of the judge. Now, I think the way in which courts like the ICJ have dealt with that has been reasonably clear on the burden of proof, which rests with the claimant, unless it is a proposition of fact which the defendant state is asserting. And you see that very clearly enunciated, for example, in our recent judgment in the Pulp Mills case. And I think it was rightly twitched a little, refined, in the recent judgment in Amadou Diallo, where, for example, the court accepted the proposition that if Congo, as the state which had detained Mr. Diallo, claimed that he had been released on a particular date and rearrested, then their failure to produce the order for his release, the document discharging him from jail, when they had produced such a document in relation to an earlier discharge of this defendant from jail, raised a strong presumption that he had in fact remained in custody during the relevant period. But standard of proof is a lot less clear. And I think, again, this is an area where there is more than a matter of semantics at stake. It becomes important and difficult to refine quite what the standard being applied is. In criminal law, it's even more acute, not just between the civil lawyers and the civil lawyers and the common lawyers, but between different groups of common lawyers. The ICTY got itself into terrible difficulties in its early years because its British lawyers were saying, well, we can't talk to the witnesses before they give evidence. We'll be struck off if we do. And the Americans were saying, we've got to talk to the witnesses and prep them for the hearing. We'll be struck off for unethical conduct if we don't. Now, part of the answer is always to ensure you have both English and American lawyers on any legal team. And then the Americans can see the witnesses in the woodshed beforehand, and the British can pretend that they have nothing whatever to do with it. That would be one approach to it. But that small vignette is an instance of a much bigger problem of trying to hammer out a workable system when you don't have common procedural assumptions between judges from different traditions. Incidentally, diversity in the judiciary is very much a buzzword in Britain at the moment. In Britain, it tends to mean how many of your top judges didn't go to Oxford and Cambridge. Well, that shouldn't be a problem in the ICJ because the electoral system ensures that the 15 judges are drawn from all the different continents and common legal systems under a rather complicated formula. That hasn't prevented 5 of the current 15 being Cambridge graduates, but I regard that simply as a testimony to quality in the electoral system. But a much bigger issue about diversity of judges is that whichever university they went to, if you get three English judges sitting in the Court of Appeal, whatever their family backgrounds, whatever their education, they almost certainly spent the 20 years before they became judges doing the same thing. They stood on the other side of the courtroom working as advocates. The same would be true in the United States and in Australia. If you go into a French court, they would all have started as lower level magistrates and worked their way up. But in our court, the 15 of us come from very considerably different backgrounds. For example, very few were advocates before they became judges. Some were professors, many of them were civil servants, 2 were government ministers. They're all international lawyers, they're all extremely good lawyers, but they do come from very different standpoints. And that also can give rise to a challenge infusing a collegial atmosphere amongst the court. But I think it's one that doesn't create great problems these days in the ICJ. But on this challenge, I think the really critical thing is that you have to have courts that are staffed by judges who not only know the law, but also have an understanding of how to deal with evidence, with the quantification of damages, with the conduct of trials. It is simply no good taking somebody who has a first-class mind and an expert knowledge of the law if they have no feel at all for how to deal with witness evidence. And then a third challenge, and this is going to have to be the last one for two reasons. The first is that we're running short of time, and the second is I've left the last few pages of my notes at home. The third challenge is that because there is no real system of compulsory jurisdiction in international law, jurisdictional disputes occupy a quite disproportionate part of the court's time. But not only that, it also gives rise to real difficulties in a great many cases in trying to squeeze a case that is really about one subject into a jurisdictional clause that was designed to deal with something else. Now, especially with James Crawford's BDI fixed upon me, I'm not going to give you any practical examples. Suffice it to say that there is one legal authority which beautifully encapsulates the problem, and that is the well-known legal authority of Cinderella. You may remember, those of you who like fairy stories or who have children to whom you read fairy stories today, that Cinderella captivated everyone's attention at the ball, but then had to change back into the rags of a mere peasant. It sounds like a human rights case, but it isn't. And all that was left behind was a single glass slipper. And the prince went round the country getting young women to try and squeeze their feet into the glass slipper. Cinderella's two ugly sisters had great difficulty squeezing their size 10s into this dainty little glass item. Most of the time in international law, you find that you have to try and squeeze a rather large and perhaps ungainly foot into the glass slipper of a jurisdictional clause that really is far too small for the case you want to bring. In national courts, incidentally, the problem is magnified because not only can you sometimes have the Cinderella problem, but you also have the difficulty that with a national court, it frequently has to apply international law through the frame of various national rules. For example, about parliamentary sovereignty, about binding precedent, about non-justiciability of certain types of issue. Now that means that you end up with something rather like the mirrors that you sometimes find in fairgrounds that distort the image in front of them. So that if you stand up very close to the image, very close to the mirror, you look very short and very fat. Or if you take a few steps back from the mirror, in my case these days, several steps back from the mirror, you look very tall and very thin. It's that type of distorted image of international law which you frequently find national courts having to apply through no fault of their own, but simply because of the national rules that they deal with. Now, I think what was on sheet number 6 was almost certainly fragmentation, the last challenge. There's always the difficulty that as there is no hierarchy of courts in international law, no system of appeals, you end up with each different court going its own way. I have to say, I think that this is a much exaggerated problem in practice. The example that is always given is that the appeals chamber of the ICTY took a very different view about state responsibility for the acts of irregular bands, non-state actors, from the view taken a few years earlier by the International Court of Justice in the Nicaragua case. Why does this appear in every article on fragmentation? The answer is because it's the only really clear-cut case of this type of conflict happening. Most of the others that get thrown in are in reality cases where a court had a different set of rules to apply or was dealing with a treaty which, because of its object and purpose, could plausibly be given a different interpretation from the treaty that was at issue in previous proceedings. But nevertheless, it does highlight the difficulty for all of us that we need to be constantly reminded that, in John Donne's words, no man is an island entire of himself, but a part of the continent, a piece of the main. There is only one system of international law, we all apply it. I remember in one of my cases at the bar many years ago, an outraged human rights lawyer responding to a submission I had made by saying, "But mere international law cannot prevail over the European Convention on Human Rights." Which I thought rather misunderstood the nature of the Convention on Human Rights as a treaty, and certainly doesn't reflect the approach that Strasbourg has taken to interpretation. So those are a few of the challenges that I think we have to face today. I'll stop at that point. I'm happy to take any questions you might want to ask. Feel free to ask whatever you like, but please bear in mind there are probably some questions that I can't with propriety answer, and so if I have to duck them, I'm sure you'll understand.